Hello and welcome to this podcast for the RCN Research Society. My name is Dr. Gordon Hill. I'm the Assistant Head for International in the School of Health and Life Sciences at Glasgow Caledonian University. And this is part of our programme where we plan to share information about the Research Society. And as part of that, we will be doing podcasts and blogs. And this is the first podcast of that series. And I'm joined here today by Professor Bridget Johnson. And Bridget, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, so I'm chair of the RCN Research Society, but my job is I'm a clinical professor of nursing and palliative care at the University of Glasgow, and I'm what's called a clinical academic, and I have a joint appointment with the NHS, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde.
And I should say I'm a member of the steering committee for the RCN Research Society as well. So what we thought we'd start off with was really just a bit of an introduction about how Bridget and I got actually started in nursing. So Bridget, do you want to kick off with that? About what were your first steps in nursing?
So I was thinking about this because, I mean, we want to, the point of this podcast is that Gordon and I want to just chat about research, but particularly we want to encourage nurses who haven't necessarily probably even thought about research as a career or being involved in research to think about being involved in research. And I did my nurse training, the original apprenticeship style training in London at St Bartholomew's Hospital, commonly known as BARTS. And although it was the apprenticeship style training, we were introduced to research. And I remember, since this is an RCN podcast, being the first piece of research I really read was part of an RCN monograph series, which are still available in the RCN library in London, which holds so many historical articles and books around nursing. So I read one of these monographs, which just a short booklet, really, and it was called Will This Hurt? And it was about preparing children for surgery. And that monograph series are some of the people who become the big names in nursing. So that was my first ever introduction to research, reading this monograph as a young, 18, 19-year-old student nurse. So that was my first ever thought that there was such a thing that nurses could do that was research.
Okay, and what attracted you to nursing in the first place?
Oh, God, I am one of those people, and there aren't many left now who always wanted to be a nurse.
Okay.
Since I was a small child. Mm-hmm. I had an aunt who was a midwife, and seeing her and what she did. So, oh my God. So we're probably a similar vintage, Gordon, but I remember there was a programme on the TV called Angels. Do you remember that?
Yeah, Pauline Quirk.
Yep. Pauline Quirk. I loved that programme. Mm-hmm. So that was a heavy influence when I think that would have been when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I might have been younger than that. I think I can't remember when it was on, but anyway, I can remember it being on when I was still at school.
Yeah, it was sort of mid-80s, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, it was before that.
Oh, was it? Right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it would have been 70s.
All right,
Yeah, we don't show our age. No. So, I mean, obviously the world was different. I mean, there's no such thing as social media. We had TV and films was really where you, and books. Mm. So I read a lot of books. There was a series, and I think it was Sue Barton was the, and they were about nurses working in lots of different areas. So even before I started nursing, I knew nurses could work in all sorts of areas and didn't have to be your traditional mm-hmm. medical surgical, which people still think in 2023, it's scary. But, when I started, I knew that you could work in lots of different areas. And I also had a cousin who'd been a nurse. So Catherine's a lot older than me, but she went straight from nursing to work in a department store. So that was like the beginning of occupational health.
Really. Yeah, yeah.
So, she still kept, her nursing registration, but she never worked in that traditional setting. So I think I knew very early on that you didn't have to work in a hospital to be a nurse.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. My first experience or considering nursing is quite different because I didn't have any members of my family that were that were nurses. And certainly growing up in working class Leith, an occupation for a man to be a nurse, this wasn't on the radar. I'm 6'4", so I was always going to be a policeman, or I was always going to do something that would, along those kind of lines. But I actually did really badly in my exams in fourth year, and one of my friends, Tom, he dragged me along to a careers fair at Edinburgh University, and they had all the stalls for the different universities, and one of the few subjects that I did pass was biology, so I was in the queue for biological sciences, and the queue wasn't getting anywhere, it was just taking ages, so I turned around and saw this stall for Queen Margaret College, as it was at the time. And there wasn't anyone there, so I went over, and David Owens was one of the lecturers there, and he was just so enthusiastic about more men getting into nursing, and it kind of just planted a seed from there. So my sort of joke is I got into nursing because the queue was shorter.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. I like that story. That's really good. Yeah.
But, you know, I've never, ever regretted that decision, you know, and it is funny that the... that there's actually been a couple of lads who I was at school with who then subsequently have come back to me and said they would have liked to have gone into nursing, but they just didn't feel, given the friendship groups they had, that they could do that. So it certainly gave me the impetus to kind of stick in. In fifth and sixth year, I got the grades to get into QMC. And yeah, so that was a 4.5 year bachelor's programme. I didn't have honours at the time.
So, and that's really interesting you did that, because when I started, there were degree programmes, and you know, Scotland was one of the, you know, there were a few around in all four nations. But Barts, with, it was then City of London University, did the integrated degree course, but I didn't choose it. And I don't actually regret that, because straight away I did do, so I did my... traditional 3 years, and then I did just not quite a year working at Barts, and then I went straight to university. So although it took me longer to get my degree, actually that starting off doing that apprenticeship style actually gave me a really good foundation in nursing. So it took me a bit longer. I think advice wasn't so good, Gordon. Because all the courses are degree courses, you know, the people choosing nursing have a different path to we had. You know, the advice wasn't very good.
No. And I didn't, you know, there was a basically my decision-making process was, well, I've got the grades to go in and do the degree programme. It wasn't any more kind of thought out than that. I know some of my friends had gone off to West Lothian and done their training at Bangor and done a 3-year programme. And I think it is really, when I kind of reflect on it, is one of those kind of no wrong path type things, isn't it? You know, that you just find your own way. And a lot of people who did the 3-year programme then subsequently went on and did a top-up degree, masters, etc. So it's, as I say, you know, and I think we were talking about it before, about how when people complete their programme, you know, their experience, they'll find their way, you know, they'll get the job that they get, they get the experience they have, and then they really build their career from there. But hopefully they'll have had some exposure to research through their programme, and then they can build on that when through their clinical
career. I think that is tricky now, though, because I think that particularly in Scotland, the way our nursing is funded, I'm very pro honours. I did honours, and that's really when I had my first proper introduction to research, because we did back then, we actually did a research project in honours. And I think if you don't, you need exposure early on to actually doing research, not just hearing about it, actually having a go at doing. And Cardiff had the first ever professor of nursing research in the UK. So we were exposed in Cardiff, you know, throughout that degree. And the other thing is, I did in my degree, we were all of us were already registered nurses. So the group, we were a smallish group. So all our tutorials were with people who had already had some exposure to nursing. So in some ways, our introduction to research was already built on some foundation. I mean, we didn't have tons of experience.
No.
We'd been through a traditional programme. However, we did have some experience, a bit more than you would have had, you know, just starting off in a degree programme. So I'm really pro honours. And I do think, you know, certainly in Scotland, so few of our programmes have, if you like, compulsory honours. And that is obviously the way that, because of the way it's funded by Scottish Government. So I do think it's difficult in our programmes here to fit a lot of research in.
But I think that there are opportunities for top-up, for people who do the three-year programme to then go on and do their honours as well separately. But I think I agree with you. I think that kind of exposure that allows, it's really, really important. Yeah. It helps to sort of set the scene.
And if we're talking about undergraduates, you could talk about what you've been able to do is the excellent program around exposure of, I mean, it can't be all students to the clinical research facility. I mean, that's just fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have loved that as a student.
Yeah.
Loved it. And obviously it can't be all because there's no way the CRF could accommodate all students. But I know it's been so incredibly well evaluated. So do you want to just tell us a bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's something that's been in place for a while now. And actually pre-COVID, I think the students started to go. So you're right, it's a relatively small number that can have that experience. But it really exposes people. And I think this is something that the undergraduate programmes that we're getting better at, but we could probably still do a bit more, is about exposing student nurses and student midwives to kind of how to undertake research, but also the scope of research careers within the professions. And I think there's different ways of doing that, and perhaps this podcast is something that kind of adds to that. But the students that I've been in touch with, Natalie, Tammy, and others, who they've just had a fantastic experience. And I remember Tammy did a small recording for us for a conference that we co-presented at about this, and she was saying how initially she was quite anxious about it because she wasn't sure what to expect, but she absolutely loved it. You know, the fact that there was periods where, you know, she was, you know, working with participants who were involved in a whole lot of different trials. And I think the dynamics for a research participant is different from working in a clinical area, because the people are there voluntarily, you know. But she said she felt like a scientist because she was in the laboratories and spinning samples and things. And it's just it would be great if other students could have that experience. But I think there are research personnel working across the hospitals. Yeah. I think even if it's a spoke placement at 1 or 2 days, then I think there's areas where people could have at least dip their toe a little bit in terms of research.
But the other thing is that I think the nurses need to see that nurses lead research as well. So in our Glasgow CRF, a lot of the projects, well, there's a lot of pharma projects, and a lot of them are medically led.
Mm-hmm.
I think nurses should see examples of really good quality research that's led by nurses, and we can tell them about it, but they only really get the flavour of it, if you like, if they see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be lovely if they were, you know, they could see more of that.
Yeah, and I think there's probably scope for PhD students to have that kind of exposure as well, just in terms of the practicalities of actually conducting research. And I think there's lots of skills that could be learned from these sort of environments as well.
But I suppose going off on a slight different tangent is, you know, the way nurses will have a research career is who has guided them and mentored them. And I'm a firm believer in choosing mentors, you know, throughout your career. So these aren't people that are assigned to you. These are people that you choose, and you're influenced by them. So what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I think that there's, looking back at my career, I think there's a degree of serendipity about, you know, who I've met or things that I've done, you know. But I think it's about kind of, seizing the moment, you know, and actually just seeing somebody that you know that you can learn from, somebody who inspires you and somebody who, you know, can share their experiences to kind of enrich your own journey and you know, clinically or in a research context. But absolutely, I can think of lots of people who've really positively influenced my career. And I think hopefully, you know, they kind of, as the body of nurses who have more research experience, that can kind of spread throughout the profession. And actually having people who can guide people is incredibly important.
And I would strongly encourage people who are listening to this is reach out to people. If there's something that you've read or you've seen somebody at a conference or, you know, you've heard somebody speak, reach out to them, because most people love mentoring and helping people. So, I mean, you know, and nowadays it's so easy to reach people. That, you know, just email or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Your people just love being contacted.
They do. And if somebody contacts you and say, look, I was really inspired by what you said, then I defy anyone not to, you know, want to kind of help that person and have a conversation with them. No, no, absolutely.
And sometimes people are, and I still, even at this stage of my career, I think it's sometimes quite difficult if you're in a conference to put your hand up and ask a question. Yeah. However, you can go and approach the person afterwards. You'll see with inspiring people, there's always a queue of people to talk to them. Or grab somebody in the coffee queue. I've often done that. Mm-hmm. You know, because somebody, it's easier to approach somebody if they're in the coffee queue than it is putting your hand up in the, you know, to ask a question that you feel a bit embarrassed about.
Yeah, and there's always...
There's no such thing as a silly question, though. Because I think sometimes, and as I say, I do this myself, I think about my question, and then the more I think about it, I think, oh, that's a silly question, I won't ask it. But there's no such thing.
No. Yeah. I think the times where you think that that's maybe a silly question, there's actually probably another, you know, 10 people in the audience who want to ask the same question that are thinking the same thing, you know. You're right, there's always ways of, you know, people's email addresses are freely available, you know, especially people working universities, etc. So you can always contact people after the event as well. So
yes.
I wonder if you could give us a synopsis of your research career, if you like.
Well, I got interested in research really quite early on, and then I did my honours degree in Cardiff, and I really started to get interested in research then, but it was really after Cardiff. I did a job that the particular job just doesn't exist now. It was a clinical teacher job, in working in what was then a college of nursing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved that job. So I was working on wards, working with people, and I remember thinking, oh, I really should start to be thinking about what next. But because I'd done an honours degree, you know, there were no master's courses around at the time that I was desperate to do. So anyway, I went and found somebody. So I went to talk to two people who are names in nursing, June Clark, who was a former president of the Royal College, and a brilliant guy called Kevin Gorney, who's was a professor of mental health. Kevin's now retired. And I went and spoke to them, and they were saying, oh, Bridget, you know, it sounds like you should either think about doing an MPhil, or why don't you think about PhD? And they were the first people ever even mentioned the name. I didn't think I even knew what a PhD really was.
No.
Never even heard of it. So they made me really, so then they made me think, well, maybe that is what I would like to do. So I did some courses on research methods. That was at what was then Middlesex Poly in London. And then I moved up to Scotland and I enrolled for originally was going to enrol down in England. And then I moved up here anyway. And so I did my PhD at the University of Glasgow. But Kevin was the one, particularly Kevin, who inspired me. And I saw him, Gordon, it was actually at something earlier this year. And it was just so, so lovely to see him again. He's retired now. Well known. He was a professor of mental health at the Institute of Psychiatry in London latterly, but I met him when he worked in Middlesex, and he was just so inspiring. He was one of those people who just strongly encouraged, because I think some you could easily be swayed not to, say, there I was completely naive, hadn't got a clue. I said, didn't even know what a PhD was, didn't know. And he really, really strongly encouraged me. So that was how I started out. Mm-hmm. And then I did my PhD part-time. People will know now that I actually strongly encourage people to do full-time if they can, because it's such a long journey if you do it part-time when you're working full-time. I was working in a hospice here in Scotland in Stirlingshire, and they were incredibly kind. So again, when you're starting out, nowadays it's easier for people, you know, join with like-minded people. You know, working in an area where other people are doing PhDs, I would strongly encourage, when you're the only one, it's quite lonely.
Yeah.
So, fewer nurses were. I mean, you know, it wasn't the first, you know, nurses have been doing PhDs for an awful long time, but there's a lot more now than were when I started in the 90s. So that was really, and it was, you know, it wasn't an easy path doing my PhD. There's no, you know, but I suppose I learned a lot, an awful lot, and a lot of support along the way.
I remember speaking to someone, actually at Queen Margaret University, who I did a professional doctor, and he asked me to come back afterwards, and we were having a discussion. You know, there's so much that you put into a doctorate, and it can be really, you know, more than educationally anything else you've done. Does it need to be like that, do you think?
No, but I do think, I mean, I always say, and this is my student, there's a few sayings that many people have heard me say over the years. One is they don't hand them out in Tesco's. And they don't hand them PhDs in Tesco's for a reason. You could say that about a degree, but so, you know, it's a higher degree. It's an important, significantly high qualification. So I don't think it should be easy, but nor should it necessarily have to be tortuous.
Yeah.
So no, I don't agree that it should, but I do think that it is a path, and sometimes it can feel like a roller coaster. You know, so I suppose when we're helping students, you have to try and think of things to say that actually help them along the path. And I always said to them, say to the students as well, you know, we don't want it to be like a roller coaster, but you know, nor can you jump from the bottom rung of the ladder to the top.
Yeah.
So there is a journey. That sounds like X Factor, but you know, it is something. Yeah.
It's the only time I tend to shy away from using, certainly in terms of, you know, my own lifespan, about using the term journey, but it's the only time I allow myself to actually do it, because it took me 7 years because I was doing it part time. Things were happening, you know, working full time, you know, things happening with family, etc. You know, so I do allow myself to call that a journey, because I think for me what I found tricky, but in retrospect, actually, one of the areas where I've personally grown so much is that reflective bit of it, and where actually you really kind of, I remember just sort of actually questioning everything, you know, and I guess that was kind of reassuring in a way, because I thought, well, I've got to the level now where I'm not taking anything for granted. I'm actually realizing, well, why did that happen? You know, and it was that was actually a bit of an epiphany for me, actually. Yeah.
But that is just to say that how that's with the students that are listening, your first degree, your first exposure bit matters. Mm-hmm. Now, people do different paths into nursing. So sometimes people have done a degree in biology or different things. So I would like to see that, though. You know, that it shouldn't, you know, your sort of beginning bit should be clear. So I do think it really, really matters. And, you know, and people have different paths. People, I think it's becoming more common that people are choosing nursing as a second career or second degree.
Absolutely. So I was thinking back about my own kind of introduction to a career in research. And I mean, I'd always been interested in research, and I was working in surgical admissions at the old Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh, and there was a research nurse working there on acute pancreatitis studies, and I was really interested. I've always been a person to kind of quiz people about what they're doing and what, you know, the sort of things they like about the job, etc. So she actually left to be a pharmacist and encouraged me to apply for the job, and I was lucky enough to get that. But so this would have been in the mid-90s. And I remember my, so this is a clinical research nurse post on commercial clinical trials. And the induction was a half-hour discussion with the principal investigator about acute pancreatitis. And then he gave me a radio pager, quite a complex one for the time. So it was one where people would have to phone up a call centre. They would dictate a message, and this would come up on my pager. And that was it. I was just kind of thrown in at the deep end, and this was before the days of the internet. So it was actually really difficult to actually find out a lot about research and what I should know. But I sort of fumbled my way through, and sort of with colleagues who were working there. But yeah, so I did that for a while, and then in 1997 I was appointed as the Associate Nurse Manager in the Wellcome Trust Clinical Research Facility in Edinburgh. So this was one of the first five clinical research facilities that were funded by the Wellcome Trust, and they opened up around about the year 2000. So I did that for 10 years, and my role really developed from a kind of managing the staff there in one of the sites. And a big component of it was actually about the support and education for the clinical research nurses. So when I moved to Edinburgh Napier University, we were actually approached by COVANS, a contract research organisation, to devise a postgraduate certificate in clinical research. And we also delivered a postgraduate and top-up degree in clinical research in the UK sector. And then also we were commissioned by the Singaporean government to devise an MSc in clinical research for clinical research associates over there. So my role, again, fairly organically, you know, had elements of clinical research. And it's funny, you were talking about how you began to consider doing a PhD, but I distinctly remember sitting, and Juliet and I were talking about this, sitting in, I think it was the RCN Research Conference in Belfast, both of us thinking, you know, we should really start thinking about doing our doctorates here. So Juliet MacArthur is now professor at Queen's University in Belfast and has the equivalent of your role through an NHS Lothian. So we decided at that point, and Juliet got her PhD, and as I say, I'd done a professional doctorate, and up until the time that I'd started to consider it, it was actually the dean of the school that I was in at the time said, had you thought about a professional doctorate, because I'd only heard of PhDs. And because my background was really in clinical research and didn't really have a clinical specialty to hang a PhD on, so I kind of struggled, and I did think about wound care and different areas, but then when I looked into doing a professional doctorate, then I thought, well, actually, I could use my experience in clinical research nursing to hang the actual main topics for the professional doctorate on. So I did my thesis on the experiences of clinical research nurses and conducting clinical trials with clinical nursing colleagues.
You know, we're just talking about, you know, PhDs, but I think, you know, both of us have had postdoctoral careers, different careers. But, I mean, that was one of the things that I certainly find with particularly now that I have, you know, supported and continue to support particularly nurses who want to do PhDs. Mm-hmm. You know, that when you really learn about research, obviously you had a lot of experience in terms of research delivery, but I don't have that experience. I think you really learn about research is after your PhD, because the PhD, of course, is a training. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I really want to see, and we don't have parity across the four nations around this, is postdoctoral opportunities for nurses and midwives and AHPs, but we're particularly talking about nurses today because of the Royal College, because I enjoyed working at the hospice, and it suited me when my children were small, because, you know, it was near home, and I could work part-time. So I worked as a lecturer at the hospice. While I was there, I ran a postgraduate diploma in palliative nursing with Glasgow University, and we did lots and lots of sort of short courses. So it's fun for teaching, because, you know, there was a different thing almost every day. But I wasn't, you know, it wasn't a particularly research active hospice. There are some, but not many across the UK. So I sort of knew that if I wanted to really embed myself in research, I needed to go and work in a university. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stay at the hospice. And I actually got a postdoctoral scholarship, and I went to work at Stirling Uni. Stirling Uni at the time had a cancer care research centre. And the prof who ran the centre at the time, you know, basically said to me, if you find a postdoc, we'd love to have you here. So I knew I had to find the opportunity. So, and there was an opportunity at the time. And then when you're saying about being opportunistic, I think as nurses, you know, sometimes we're good at that, but we have to be. You know, these things don't get handed to you on a plate. Yes, you can search them out, but there's a funder called Medical Research Scotland, which had mainly funded, and it mainly still does fund, bright young medics and dentists who want to do basic science, actually clinical science, but they had an opportunity that they were reaching out to NMAPS, and you know, and it was because of a particular person who'd left the money who'd said in her will that she wanted it to go to a nurse midwife or allied health professional. She included psychology, I think, in there. And I think I was just, when I went along for my interview, my project was nothing like anything that they'd ever seen before. So I saw the opportunity, went for it, and got it. Yeah. And that was a 2-year, postdocs are often 3 years, mine was 2 years, but, you know, I managed to achieve a lot in those 2 years. And then that was the start of my academic career, really.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people in a variety of things, especially in doctoral theses, where they'll say, you know, they've identified gaps in their work, but then say this needs to be done. But
they don't do it.
So the postdoctoral space doesn't necessarily need to be that, but it does allow people to kind of expand on the findings or the results that they've had.
I mean, the other thing is, I strongly advise students so all my students publish during their PhD. So the advantage of that is, I think when you get to the end, when I got to the end of my PhD, I had my son in the middle, and then I was pregnant with my viva, and I was concentrating on being a mum of small children. Do you know, getting publications wasn't foremost in my mind. Mm-hmm. And then time moves on, and it was only when I was, you know, thinking about postdoc, and Nora Keeney said to me, she said, Bridget, you can't come to Stirling unless you've got some good publications. So I thought, I had some, but, you know, not many at all.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I do with the PhD group at the University of Glasgow with me is that I make public involvement compulsory, and we've just got a paper coming out. It's coming out in one of the Royal College of Nursing journals. It should be out in the next couple of weeks, where we outline how we did that, because each student does it slightly differently. And I think I wouldn't ever have one path, because, you know, projects are different,
yeah,
and students are different.
Their journeys are different.
And their journeys are different. But every single one of those students has benefited. And actually, I'll just say now, so Baha, as a student I had from Palestine, who did a study around cultural aspects of palliative care and heart failure. And, you know, Baha came to Scotland with completely different cultural background from Palestine, but he was the sort of person, he's very sociable. Mm-hmm. So he thoroughly enjoyed when I said, you know, we're going to have to get some public involvement in your research. And his public advisor came to his graduation.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that was how strong the bond became. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really important. I wonder if we could maybe have a wee discussion about the research society, Research Society,
yeah,
now, and what sort of things that the research society are involved in.
Mm.
I don't know, maybe start off with, I mean, I know there's a piece of work around the last ref and the impact of that.
So that's a piece of work that has been completed and is being written up at the moment. So that's a group of people from, not just from the Research Society, but from the Royal College, who did a piece of work looking at the nursing contribution to REF in terms of impact case studies. So impact, I mean, I always argue that you'd think that nursing as an academic discipline would be one of the most impactful, but just the way that it's written in terms of, you know, sort of in an academic way, it isn't quite as simple as that. However, I do think we should be the profession that's, you know, should be able to talk about our impact. But an impact case study written for the research excellent framework in the United Kingdom, it has to be written in a certain way, and you have to show academic impact or prove your impact, more to the point. So we were looking at the case studies that were submitted to the last REF, and we've grouped them according to themes, but also where it was clear that a nurse had led that research as opposed to involving nurses. So that's something that happens quite a lot. You know, there'll be research all over the UK and beyond where nurses are involved, you know, sometimes as participants, or sometimes they're absolutely integral to the project, but they're not leading it.
Mm.
And I think the clinical research facility is an example of that. So there's nurses involved in delivery that are absolutely fundamental to their project, but they're not necessarily the ones with their name on the paper.
Yeah.
I think that world is changing, but
I think especially in the non-commercial research, that there's much more recognition of the intellectual contribution of everyone who's part of the team, and certainly in terms of the proposals and publications, then there's more clinical research nurses that are down, as quite rightly, as co-investigators.
Yeah.
But I think that's something that's evolving, I would say, as well.
Yeah, because it's a really, really important. And actually, I think also the overlap. I mean, we've talked as a research society, we've talked about, you know, sort of our strap line, if you like, as nurses participating, delivering and leading research. And obviously there's overlap in all those areas. Not all nurses will lead research. Not all want to. So, I mean, I would love to see a lot more nurses. So nurses who are listening to this who want to lead research, please talk to people. Mm-hmm. Talk to, you know, we said before, find people in your local area or beyond. And these days with the internet, you can talk to anybody in the world if you're interested in working towards leading research. But the delivery bit is so important. And there is an overlap and should be an overlap between delivery and leading.
Yeah.
I mean, they shouldn't all be two completely separate entities.
No.
And the same with participating. You know, if there's a research study in your area, you know, get involved. I mean, even if you're not even asked to, you know, so, you know, even just, you know, being involved as a participant or being involved in helping collect data, analyze data, you'll learn.
Yeah. Mm. One of the best things I did was got involved with one of the research ethics committees, and
yes,
you know, and
it was
a fantastic. I actually ended up being the deputy chair, and it was when one of the times that the new documentation came in, and Professor Peter Hayes was the chair of the committee, and he was decided to be off on holiday that week. So I remember chairing the committee when nobody really knew how the paperwork was working, but that was a fantastic experience, and I learned so much just in terms of, you know, actually. Because one of the big things, I think, actually formulating what research projects you're doing and actually putting that down in a way that the public can understand, because that's often a very difficult thing to do, to put things into layman's terms, you know. So that whole process and how people trying to grapple with that.
I get students to do that. It's another thing that I make all my students say, be careful of saying compulsory, but actually writing a lay summary. And I say to them, you know, you would have so much experience of this on an ethics committee, because sometimes a lay summary is not very lay.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to people, you know, write it for sort of primary school age and test it out. Sometimes they can do it too simply. So you don't want it too simple, but it should be something that's, you know, clear to anybody who doesn't know your discipline.
Yeah. Because throughout their kind of whether working on that, then people who aren't in nursing or any kind of healthcare profession will ask them, oh, what is it you're doing? And you've got to be able to explain it to them in a way that you know, that's understandable. And I think that's really, really valuable.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that and I don't know if your university does, many, many universities participate in a scheme called 3-minute thesis.
Mm, yeah.
And I get my students to do that as well, because it's basically one slide describing, and it's so good. I wish somebody had made me do that.
Yeah.
Because it really forces you to be concise, and that's supposed to be for any audience.
Yeah, that's like the elevator pitch thing as well, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Same thing,
So one of the things you were talking about there is actually reaching out or connecting with people, and one of the ways they can do that is, of course, come along to the RCN Research Conference.
Yes.
So we're speaking, as we speak today, then the conference is down in Manchester next week.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic way to kind of connect with people, because as well as kind of mentors, those as well as mentors, there's also the peers that you have as well, you know.
That's so important. I mean, going to a face-to-face conference, people, if you haven't been before, is just such a brilliant way. I went quite young, as in young in my career and young in age, and it is quite scary when you first go. But remember, you can speak to people, you know, you get such brilliant conversations, coffee queue, grab. And actually what we do at the conference is that we arrange various ways that people, you know, sort of support people to network, if you like, and support, you know, we're doing something at this year's conference about connecting what we call an early career researcher with somebody with lots of experience. So we're going to do it in a sort of speed dating way. So, you know, if somebody comes to my table and decide they don't want to speak to me, they can move on to the next thing. Because, you know, obviously people have different, you know, things that they want to ask. So, going to a conference and people, you know, we do understand that conferences can be expensive, because it's not just the fee for the conference. You have to think about, you know, accommodation when you're there, and getting there. But particularly those people who are students, there's always ways of going to a conference cheaper or getting a free place sometimes. So, for instance, when the conference is in your area, you can get a free place by helping out. So reach out. So those people, particularly junior in your career, students, you know, you're on a budget, you know, whether you're on a student grant or a bursary here in Scotland, it's not much money. You know, try and see if you can get one of the helping out places, because there's always people you need to show people to the rooms, you know, just all sorts of helping roles at conferences, standing on reception desk, all these sort of things, you know, there's always ways and means. So please don't, and also there are bursaries to help. So the Royal College, for instance, you know, there are bursaries that you can apply for to help fund your conference. So please don't be put off if you look at the price and think that's completely out of my budget.
Yeah, and there's also opportunities to be on a local organising committee, etc. And then I think, I remember, I mean, obviously I mentioned about the conference in Belfast, and I think I found them hugely inspiring as well, hearing about the breadth of the work that was going on. And it certainly inspired me to kind of carry on my sort of doctoral studies, if you like.
So my first ever RCN conference was in the 90s. So I was here in Scotland, and I went down to a conference, and it was in Newcastle. And I can remember that was my first ever experience of doing a poster at a conference. And honestly, people, completely different to how we did posters back then to how you did now, because nowadays, you know, you can get lots and lots of help and lots of apps that will help you do a good poster. But actually, that's a good way of doing it as well, because that's one of the things that we do in the NHS as well, really encouraging people to disseminate their work. And a poster is a really, really great way. The last time we need to do, it's something that we will be bringing back to Greater Glasgow and Clyde, is, you know, sort of nursing conference, if you like, for staff. But the last one we did was myself and Mark Cooper, who's a Dr. Mark Cooper, who's a nurse consultant in advanced practice. We judged the posters, and we were so impressed.
Yeah.
And so these were people, you know, clinicians, you know, charge nurses, et cetera, who were the first time ever sometimes. And honestly, such innovative ways of displaying their work, disseminating their work. If I remember rightly, one of the ones that won, and it was a project around liver failure, they'd done it on a Star Trek theme.
Wow.
And I'm not a Star Trek fan, but it was just so, you know, I loved the way that they did that, both in terms of thinking about it very carefully in terms of the themes, but also the way it was displayed as well.
And I think things like that, where you can grab someone's attention and,
yeah.
And one of the other things I was going to mention, and we'll come back to some of the other work of the society, but we do obviously have social media as well.
Yes.
So even if you're not able to come along to the conference, then do follow. It's hashtag RCN Research 23 is the hashtag for the conference. And our Twitter or X handle is at RCN Research SOC. So even if you're not able to come along to the conference, then please do keep an eye on those, because you'll see people tweeting about the conference and what they've heard or what they've presented, and that can often be another way to find out about what's been discussed, and again reach out to people that you would like to connect with.
And the other thing is about watch our social media, and Gordon's going to be in charge of that, so he's going to be really busy at the conference, but one of the things that we can do on social media is put links to the papers, so published papers from the conference, or sometimes, you know, sort of wider reading around a topic. So actually, I have found, even myself, it's such a brilliant way of getting access to articles, particularly if you're busy. So that some of the people listening will be really busy, you know, in their day job, and you think, oh, I haven't got time to do a literature search. Well, sometimes, you know, looking at social media, looking for a hashtag of a topic, safe staffing is an obvious one in nursing coming to mind. You'll find, you know, a lot of information. So please follow our social media and look at some of the hashtags that we do around what will be some of the key topics at the conference as well. The other thing is that what we might be able to do, it's probably going to be quite a lot of work for us, but, you know, just displaying some of the posters on social media as well, because then, so, you know, you'll be able to see you know, a flavour of what's being presented.
Yeah, and often people will take photographs next to their poster so you can zoom in and see what it's about. One of the other aspects of the Research Society that's very close to my heart is the subcommittee, the Clinical Research Subcommittee. Helen Jones is one of the leaders of the RCN Clinical Research Subcommittee, and Helen and I were hoping to get some funding to do some oral histories of clinical research nurses who were perhaps practicing in the 80s, possibly the 70s, but certainly the 80s and 90s, just to capture some of the early history of this work. So that's something we're hoping to do. But they also have held an annual conference, and I think moving forward that might be incorporated into the general conference.
And I think that you said another really good point, because that's the other point, because those people listening, you know, have a very different to when I started out in nursing and my research career, that there wasn't an internet. When I was doing my degree in Cardiff, you had to look references up in a massive, like, you know, catalogue-y thing.
Yeah, I did.
You know, you have so many more opportunities now. And actually, I think, you know, and if you're the sort of person that finds reading a textbook really hard, you know, look on YouTube, listen to podcasts. All of these are ways that you can learn about research, and you can get, you know, your textbook in various different forms now. Yeah. You know, people's reading it as an audiobook, you know, etc. So I still find it sometimes quite difficult to read a book. I sometimes do have a Kindle, but sometimes a textbook, you know, you want to go back and forth. It's not like reading a novel where you're going from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And actual fact, I always think that that's one way where then you tell, you know, it speaks volumes about a textbook if you can actually read it from beginning to end. Most you can't. And some research texts can be quite tricky. But if you, you know, watch on YouTube, listen to podcasts, you'll get a really, really good flavour of what that author's saying.
Absolutely. One of the other things we're getting involved in is with the RCN Institute as well. Mm-hmm. So I think the Research Society, that's kind of, or research goes across the whole Institute and the different pillars of that. But do you want to say a little bit?
I mean, I think that we're going to have an announcement at the conference, and then those people who come to Congress will have seen some announcement at Congress in Brighton in May, and we'll hear more about it next year as well. So this is a new, you know, some people will know that there has been previous iterations of RCN Institute. So this is a brand new iteration of an RCN Institute, and there will be different pillars. But as Gordon said, you know, as perhaps we should expect, research is going to run along all the different areas. And so that there'll be lots and lots of opportunities. I mean, there's also something some people, and this isn't something that we're heavily involved with as the Research Society, but there is something called RCN Learn. And those people who are members, there's an awful lot of there's an awful lot of material that you can access for free. So, you know, that's really, and that will be tied into the Institute as well. So when you're accessing material, you know, that for CPD purposes or towards a qualification, you know, it'll be available online. So it isn't always about going to a face-to-face course. There'll be an awful lot of material. So yes, so watch this space with hearing a little bit more around the Institute, as you know, a further series in this podcasts will be asking colleagues in the RCN to tell us more. Just those people who are interested in the forums, like our forum as a research society, we're volunteers. So Gordon, myself, we've told you what we do as our day job. We're not employed by the RCN. We volunteer to be on this committee. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's a member can volunteer to be on any committee. And we're really, really interested. Those people are interested in research. If you get a choice when you, as any member, of saying which forum that you're interested in. And remember, we've got the Clinical Research Forum as well as the Research Society. When you're ticking the box, if you tick research as first, then you get an opportunity to vote as well, to vote, to be a voting member, i.e. a free member at Congress as well. So those people who haven't ever been to Congress, please, please apply. If you would like a free place to Congress and you're a member of the RCN and you're a member of our forum, you can be a free voting member.
And there's lots of different forums. I'm not sure if it's forums or fora, but anyway, there's lots of them that are available within the RCN. So please do have a look at the RCN website and join any of them that you really fit your experience or your interests as well.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that we're interested in our forum is in, you know, is research education as well. So when we're talking about research education, obviously that can fulfill all sorts of areas, but often that can be about methods. And we will have some modules. We've got a project working with from our forum, working with King's College London, NIHR, that's the National Institute for Health Research, and the RCN, where there'll be some courses available, material available around research methods. So again, once we have more information on that, we'll let you all know.
And one of the things about in the research societies, we're hoping to restart the newsletter, a virtual newsletter, so that anyone who's member of the research society will get that popping into their inbox and their emails. So look out for that starting again very soon.
And one of the things that we know nursing across, this isn't just the UK, but we're talking about the UK today, that it is hard to get time off for things like CPD, but also to get funding for courses. So one of the things that we'll be doing in our newsletter is when we know of funding available, we'll highlight that. I always think that you can, that the hardest thing is it's harder to get time off than it is to get the money. Mm-hmm. You can always find the money. There always will be a way of finding of the money for a course or to fund, you know, it's harder if you want to do a full-time course, but if you're going to do a part-time course, you can always find the money for the fees, for instance. It is harder to argue for the time off in the current climate. But we will give we will let people know of opportunities for courses and particularly for money towards research courses.
And it's one of the things, it's actually how I found out about the Research Society is when getting the newsletters. I think Dave O'Carroll and Anne McMahon used to send those out, and it was incredibly useful just in terms of that kind of focus for research in nursing, and being able to be able people to tell you about jobs, tell you about events that are coming up and funding as well.
Yeah, yes. And in terms of events, because there's so many different events, and of course nowadays you can find an awful lot available online, but as we said, I mean, I certainly learn the most by meeting with other people, and it's the way I learn better is by talking to and interacting with other people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously that's not always going to be possible for everybody listening, but if you do get opportunities to go to face-to-face things, you'll get something different out of that.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I'd just like to tie things off there and just thank everyone for listening. I hope that you've found the last almost an hour, in fact, interesting and informative. And if you would like to find out more about the RCN Research Society, then you can do that via the RCN website or just by Googling Bridget or myself, then you'll be able to get our contact details as well if you would like to reach out to us.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks very much.